Welcome to Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria, with Andrea Barstorff-Hager.
Welcome to the Care in Action podcast. Today, a very warm welcome to our online guest, Nivi Sharma. Hi, good morning, Nivi.
Hi, good morning, Andrea.
Nivi is based in Nairobi, Kenya. And as always, I give a short introduction of our guest. Nivi Sharma is the CEO of Bridges to Prosperity, a global organization dedicated to building pedestrian bridges in isolated rural areas to provide people with access to education, healthcare, and economic opportunities. As I said, she's based in Nairobi, Kenya. She brings extensive experience in innovation and access technologies, from digitizing the Kenyan school curriculum to improving internet access in remote actions. Nivi is a very passionate advocate for sustainable development and serves as an independent director at Standard Chartered Bank Kenya and other boards. Her work creates bridges, quite literally, and I would say it aligns perfectly with CARE's mission to empower the disadvantaged communities worldwide. But we will tap right into the conversation. So Nivi, just give us an idea, one sentence or two sentences. What is the vision of Bridges to Prosperity, your organization?
Thank you, Andrea. I think I'll start by addressing, you know, is it my organization? It really isn't. I always say it's the organization of rural communities everywhere, all over the world. And at the heart of it is this core belief that connection is the heart of opportunity. Connection can unlock opportunity on all levels, from economic, education, healthcare, gender, climate, almost every dimension of development you can think of. Infrastructure and connection can unlock that. But our vision really at B2P is to see a world where poverty caused by rural isolation no longer exists.
Yeah, which is really one of the key factors that also organizations like CARE have to struggle with. I think both of us and that we're sharing common are very close to our work and invest a lot of time and are very passionate about our work. So how did it come that you joined Bridges to Prosperity? What happened before that, Nivi? Just share a few of your stations with us, please.
Well, I started my career in tech, like a lot of people from Nairobi probably do, specifically education technology and tech. And at the time, there was a big... There was a lot of hype and excitement around something in India called the Akash tablet. And it was said like $35 per tablet and the whole curriculum is there. And I remember the permanent secretary of ICT in Kenya had just come back from India and said, I wish someone would digitize the Kenyan curriculum and we would put it on a cheap tablet like this. Mm-hmm. And so I went away and did that with my best friend. We co-founded an organization called Elimu. Elimu in Swahili means education. And so we named it Elimu. We digitized the whole revision curriculum of the primary education system. And, you know, when we go to the schools that we started this organization for, we kept hitting the same barrier. Teachers and head teachers and school owners would say, this is great. Of course we can see why children are getting better grades. Of course we can see why children are even reading better and getting better literacy when they use this kind of content. But hey, lady, we don't even have electricity in the school. We don't have a computer lab. We don't have connectivity. Half of our teachers barely have a smartphone. So, how can we use your content to improve our learning outcomes? So I kept running into this problem of infrastructure in education. And that's when I pivoted to an organization called BRIC, where we built infrastructure and hardware for Africa. So built in Africa for Africa, to deal with unreliable connectivity, power, rugged environments, extreme weather conditions, and so on.
Is it correct?
We did an excellent job with that.
Is it correct that you are talking about rural areas now, right? And remote areas, or are you talking about the urban regions?
So at that time, our two use cases was informal settlements in urban areas, so very, very underserved areas in urban as well as rural. And you said if it can work there, then it can work anywhere in Kenya. Like, you know, those two kind of extreme use cases. That's what we were designing for.
Was that before COVID or after COVID or during COVID?
Before COVID. It was before COVID, and we really struggled. You know, a lot of organizations say we want innovation. We want to be forward-looking. We want technology. But then at the same time, they also say, well, where is the research that this works? And innovation and trial and tested and research interventions are a juxtaposition. Those two things are not the same. And then, of course, you know, we had to scale that down. And then when COVID happened, those same people came knocking on our doors and saying, this is the perfect time, 3 years later, 3 years too late, to roll out education technology.
So I would even say that not only for NGOs, but we are talking about NGOs today, innovation is one of the new buzzwords, as you said.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to be innovative.
And I think, you know, sometimes there's this catchphrase, human-centered design. And I think that that's a very lazy shortcut to say that we have listened and said, oh, we did human-centered design, so therefore this is what the community needs. And it's like, well, how did you actually position this intervention? How did you position this intervention in that workshop that you did? And I think we sometimes take a shortcut towards actually listening to communities, actually providing solutions that, you know, the communities today and generations before and generations in the future have wanted, had yearned for, and have needed to kind of force our agenda up. This is the innovation that we want people to adopt and like. So I think that goes, you know, on one hand, we do a disservice to the community that we serve by calling certain things innovation that are not. And then on the other hand, top down, we often talk about markets like Kenya and sub-Saharan Africa. Oh, we're going to leapfrog the West. We're going to leapfrog the West. And it makes me question, like, but is the West headed in the right direction that we want to be leapfrogging them? Why don't we want to chart our own path or go in a different direction? Because there are certain mistakes that the West has found themselves in, especially in terms of the use of technology by children. We shouldn't be leapfrogging.
I wanted to touch that topic because, especially in Scandinavia, because they were really early adopters of new technologies in primary education, and they have experience for some years already, and they go back now to the idea that I think after the age of 10 that it's good that children have the possibility to learn digitally, and it's not so good in the first years. I read this outcome, and we in Austria, we have quite a mixed bag. We have some schools that are very experimental and advanced, and then we have some that are not so much, but people try. And we had this, and the leapfrogging is maybe really not the best idea, because during COVID and after COVID, everything was excellent in digitalization because there was no alternative. But nowadays we have alternatives. And I think we have to be quite critical when it comes to confronting small children with all the new tools without having the technology mastered ourselves perfectly at the time, and also the teachers. So leapfrogging for sure is not a good idea. And I have to say that we from CARE, and especially from CARE Austria, because we have this close cooperation with Ars Electronica, and I have quite a collection in the meantime of friends and colleagues who are tech entrepreneurs in various African countries. And I look over to them to learn. So it's mutual learning, and especially when it comes to introducing innovation in African countries like Kenya or Nigeria, it is double important that people from the tech scene there are working on the suggestions, and we are channeling the funding and having mutual understanding and bring in some points, but the decision has to be made in the place where you start to implement. So tell us a bit more, was it difficult to convince communities that some tech solutions are necessary for them or would be very useful? Did you overcome the barriers in the end?
When it came to education, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, we often, if you position yourself as a techpreneur, as a tech, a technology expert, mm-hmm. And you're approaching a community in, you know, rural Samburu, rural Kenya somewhere, of course there'll be hesitance, right? But I think the key to our success is what we believe very strongly in is not only relying on the expertise of people in technology, whether they're in Europe, the USA, or Africa, but relying on the expertise of teachers. Teachers who have had, you know, 40 years of sitting in a classroom, being underpaid, overworked, 40, 60 students in a classroom once in a while. And they kept, you know, one of the things that one teacher told me that has always stuck with me is, oh yeah, someone else has come with these kind of tablets or innovation before. And so when the visitors come and they want to take pictures, we have to remove the devices so they can see that they're being used. But, you know, again, if you're a public school teacher in your average Kenyan school, you've got 40 to 60 students sitting in front of you, handing out devices. Someone has forgotten their password. One has not charged. One is broken. One, the button is cracked. The other one, the screen is cracked. And your job that day is to teach the kids how to calculate the area of a square. Now, you've taken your 40 minutes of doing that in an already resource-constrained environment, and you cut 20 to 30 minutes on just the logistics of introducing technology. Again, for a teacher like not worth getting out of bed in the morning, I can do this better and more efficiently in another way.
It sounds rather like a cumbersome exercise, to be very exactly. honest. But what is your experience? Do the kids like it?
Of course the children like it. And I think this has been one of my biggest learnings is, you know, when we designed the education technology solutions that we did, we honed in on the kids love it. The teachers hate it, but the teachers are the gatekeepers. And so in order to do this, we have to design the solution to reduce the time, the friction, the pain between when the bell rings and when learning begins. So, you know, what size the button it is, what color the headphones are on the right, on the left, you know, all of those things, all of those small, small design decisions were all designed to get that gatekeeper to say, this is not so bad. This may make my job easier. This is an asset to me rather than a liability. And that's the kind of design that I think we always have to work with the end user and the gatekeeper in mind.
Absolutely. And let's move a bit on because bridges change lives for rural communities. I looked a lot in your interviews and tell us a little bit, how many bridges did Bridges to Prosperity build in the meantime? And give us some numbers, and also how is it financed, such a bridge that Bridges to Prosperity is building also at the moment, I assume.
Yeah. So as of December 2024, we have built 668 bridges. So that is both built as well as supported, influenced, and assisted the building of, which is what we're moving more towards.
Globally, right? Not only in Kenya. Globally.
Globally. In 21 countries all over the world. We have not built, we don't have a program in Kenya, actually. Our biggest programs currently are in Rwanda, Uganda, Ethiopia, and Zambia. Mm-hmm. So 668 bridges globally, connecting over 3.6 million people around the world to opportunities. We actually think that that number, according to some latest research, is much, much bigger. Mm-hmm. What we thought that, you know, people 2 kilometers from the bridge will use that bridge, we're finding out that up to 3-4 kilometers are using the bridge without any fade out in the impact that's been had on their education, on their economic return, on their healthcare outcomes.
Mm-hmm. So you have indirect benefits of the bridges as well, right?
Well, what I'm saying is that even that direct beneficiaries of 3.6 is a very conservative estimate.
So many more, benefiting from that. And of course, I know it, but please share it with our listeners. Why is it so important to have a safe pathway living in a rural area for example, in Ethiopia or Uganda. Why is that a problem?
I really struggle with this question because on one hand, it's something that all of us know the pain of delay. When you're in traffic sometimes, you thought you would get to work in 20 minutes. If it takes 40 minutes, it's quite an inconvenience. We know the delay of everyday commuting, that if I said to you, hey, if I can cut your commute to your livelihood, being able to put bread and butter on the table for your family, from 2 hours down to 30 minutes, that would be a life changer for you, without any extra cost to you. So there's a very relatable sense of, well, of course, people, saving travel time opens up your time to do so much more. It means that you would carry more fruits or vegetables from your farm to the market if your travel time is less. It would mean that if you're going to school and not spending 2 hours getting to and from school, it means you're spending more time playing, studying, spending time with your family, reading perhaps. So doing all these other recreational and important things. If you are a woman who is in labor and you need to get to a clinic, then that's it's an issue of life and death. If you're someone who's sick and needs to get to a hospital, reducing travel time is, our core metric that goes across any kind of story that I could tell you, for a farmer, a student, a sick person, a pregnant woman, a person getting a job who's working at maybe a garment factory on the other side of the river. So it's so life-changing. And like I say, it touches so many dimensions of development. And we haven't even, considered what's happening now with the climate shock, climate crisis ahead of us. And what happens when these rivers swell? What happens when there's a drought and farmers are not able to grow as much? What kind of resilience do they need in order to access places? So on a very wet day, obviously a bridge helps you because you get to cross the river, without getting your clothes wet, which is, also a matter of really important dignity. And two, you can get there safely without risking your life. But on very hot days, cutting your travel time, walking outdoors from 2 hours to 30 or 20 minutes, that's a huge impact you can imagine on the livelihood of someone. Mm-hmm.
And this is, we know exactly what you are talking about. And we talked a lot about accessibility to schools, and especially for girls, it has to be a safe way to school and safe commuting from the village to the school. Otherwise, they are kept at home, and many children don't have the access to good school education just because of their remote living place, right? So this is really, especially for women and girls, which is the focus area of the work of CARE. In the light of that, this is extremely, extremely important. And you are building bridges for pedestrians, right? Pedestrians, yes. Motorbikes, and bicycles, I learned.
Yes, and lots of goats and cows, yes. And things, and brooks, yeah. But generally, bicycles, motorcycles, the three-wheeler tuk-tuks can also ride some of our bridges. But yes, I mean, 90% of the world doesn't own a car, much more than 90%, and especially in rural Africa. And so, yes, we build for them.
Is the maintenance of the bridges, is that intense, or is that something easygoing? And who is taking care of that?
This is another question which I think, as development experts, we need to ask these questions and think about these problems really carefully. The best form of maintenance is no maintenance. So we changed our bridges from being wooden decked to steel decked. Mm-hmm. So the wood doesn't erode and so on. The other question that I sometimes get asked is, well, if you're building these bridges for the community should maintain them. And, I really think that even in, whether it's the Netherlands or the USA, mm-hmm. if the government, fixes a road or fixes you know, builds a road outside your house and there's a pothole, they're not like, well, we built the road for you, you should build that pothole yourself, right?
Yeah, no, you're right.
Infrastructure. Yeah. It's a government asset. Yeah. And it's maintained the way the government maintains all its infrastructure assets, which, let's be honest, across the world, globally, is not done well. So what we're doing is, you know, one, leaning in on this idea that no maintenance is the best maintenance, but then secondly, leaving the community with the tools to maintain, which includes the advocacy tools of saying that, hey, you know, we need more wire or we need these particular tools. And this is the office within the local government that I can go to advocate for that. So it is, you know, it's a community-based maintenance, but it by no means puts, it never, you know, it doesn't assume unpaid labor for the community.
Yeah.
Across the world, you know, there's 10,000 bridges like this that for less than $10 a month, make sure that they're maintained for 30 to 50 years to ensure their lifetime.
Which is really an excellent example, because I fully agree with you. The idea that people give labor for free to maintain infrastructure, I would say this is very old-fashioned. This is definitely not the approach that CARE is taking. Already 20 years ago, and this was also criticized, but you will know about the cash for work program. So if people participate, then of course they have to get paid for it. But what you mentioned, the idea that in a country like the Netherlands, the US or Austria, people would take care of the maintenance of the infrastructure is somehow totally ridiculous. I'm not sure if it would happen. On the other hand, we have to admit that we have a functioning tax system. And if you have a functioning, I would say the precondition that the state really can take, or a government really can take good care of the infrastructure of a country, the precondition is a more or less functioning tax system. And this is lacking in many countries globally. There is a sort of tax system, but many people are working in shadow economy and don't pay any taxes, and then you can't take out a lot of the state as a citizen. Would you agree to that? That this is one of the underlying causes that in many cases infrastructure is not maintained like it should be, even in very rich countries. We have to struggle with that sometimes.
So when we talk about taxes, at the end of the day, the government pays for and maintains all infrastructure using its revenues, whether they come from tax or from grants or from debt and so on. When we actually look at the rate of return, that, you know, what does one $100,000 return when you're building an expressway that's a toll road? We've seen so many of those, they never pay for themselves. That's quite a common thing. And the government says, well, yes, but we're connecting two cities. It's not a direct revenue.
Yeah.
What we have seen, the most surprising results that we have seen from rural bridges is a 98.5% internal rate of return. Mm-hmm. But these bridges are paying for themselves very fast and at a much higher rate than most urban infrastructure is. The increase in education, the increase in healthcare, you know, not even the, you know, the social aspects of education and healthcare, but just the economic rate of return is so shockingly high. Mm-hmm. And remember, Andrea, we are building bridges in the most rurally isolated communities. You know, if we wanted a really high rate of return, we would build in cities because that kind of, you know, it increases the number of beneficiaries that are served in terms of population density. So even at that level, the people that are putting food on our tables, the people that are the backbone of a lot of the, you know, urban economies that we rely on, we have to consider their needs and also their economic power as much as the urban planners.
Now, of course, to build a strong civil society that has also successes in economic terms, I would say this is the precondition to have a tax system that works in the future. Otherwise, it will be very difficult. But let's stay a moment, because we see in many countries, including my own, that urban infrastructure is in the focus of governments, of course. And you, as a citizen of Kenya and Nairobi, you also benefit, of course, from the, what is it called, this new highway? The last time I was there, it was the expressway. It was under construction, and all my friends and colleagues told me we are so much looking forward to it, because commuting in a large city like Nairobi, you can't compare it to a small city like Vienna, because my commuting time from home is about 30 minutes. But we are much smaller than Nairobi, of course. Yeah. So somehow it is also understandable that where the focus of government is on urban areas, because millions of citizens are working there, and those are also the centers, of course, of economic growth. But as you mentioned, and I agree fully with you, you have to include the millions of people that live in the rural areas, and this is the role of Bridges to Prosperity, right? To connect the whole country.
That's right. And you know, when we say a lot of people live in urban, we also, like a lot of people also live in rural, right? And they're just a lot more spread out. In fact, so I think 80 or 90% of the world's poor live in rural areas. Mm-hmm. And they're putting food on the plates of the people that live in urban areas, most of them, right? So we have to be a little, like, this. I think there's always a temptation to take a very utilitarian argument towards this. Well, there's more people here. This is where the economic tax center is, so that's where we need to build. Mm-hmm. And we don't like kind of saying urban or rural, or pitting ourselves in competition with urban, because really a government should be serving all its
everybody.
For everybody, right?
Absolutely.
And the amount of investment that's made in urban infrastructure versus rural infrastructure, just the amount itself, like what I think would really move the needle is just a change of 3 to 5%. It's not a huge amount that we need to do to improve the state of rural infrastructure and create access to opportunities for everyone. And then the other part of that is not just the amount of infrastructure, but also the ease. I think a lot of governments just, you know, it's easy to do these big shiny projects. You get an investor, you get a rate of return, it's, you know, it's monetizable. We know what to do. Whereas in rural infrastructure, it's a bit harder. It's a bit harder to plan. It's a bit harder to prioritize, to design. It's certainly harder to build, you know, where your big machinery and trucks cannot go. It's a little harder to think about maintenance, maybe not do maintenance, but you know, those are surmountable challenges that organizations like B2P are here to support governments to get over. That it looks hard because it hasn't been done very well in the past, but it actually is, there's a really methodical way of approaching the standards, the manuals, the upkeep, the design and the maintenance of rural infrastructure.
Excellent. And you already mentioned that you're working with governments. Who else are your partners at B2P?
So our core partners generally when we build bridges are the rural communities. You know, we're not innovating a new place to build a bridge. We are relying on generations of people crossing a river at a certain place to get to opportunity on the other side. So number one and foremost is the communities that we serve. They are more and more becoming our end user, and the government is becoming our customer. And, you know, in an ideal state, a rural community should not even know who we are. We have a very no logo, no ego approach. The government is the customer that we support and say that this is how you build infrastructure at scale. This is how you plan it. This is how you identify and prioritize it. This is how you design it. This is how you build it. This is how you engage with community in doing it. And this is how you maintain it. So through that process, we have relied on all the, I call it dirt under our fingernails, all the bridges that we have built, all the communities that we have engaged with, all the work of identifying, prioritizing, building technology around that. And now it's really turned, it's the time in our strategy and our journey to transfer that knowledge to governments to do it.
Mm-hmm. And if I may ask, the financial side of it, are the governments also paying for the construction of the bridge? Yes?
Absolutely. You know, we do bring some philanthropy and subsidize sometimes to get the country off the ground. But our end goal, which we're, you know, seeing in lots of the programs where we work, is governments say, hey, we can do this. Like, if, you know, we're going to do this by ourselves. We're paying for the bridges. We're procuring the bridges. It just needed to kind of get on the menu where it wasn't before.
Okay, so you say that donations and how did you call it, philanthropy, is only the booster or the initial spark in financing such a bridge. And it's the ideal case, I would say, that it is financed by the government, because building infrastructure, as we said before, is one of the key topics that a government should do.
You know, a non-profit organization now aside about $10 to $15 million.
Yeah.
It could never fulfill the need to scale a national networked transport infrastructure for any country.
Yeah. But talking about your revenue, even if you are a larger organization or a global organization, you could never build global infrastructure. This is a total myth. We can spark initial financial input, but we can't do that on a global level. That's simply not. That's why institutions like the World Bank are existing, because this can't be done by NGOs. This is by far too big for us.
So we did. I think this was one of the things that I love about the organization the most, is the strategic pivot we took. Because for the first 10, 15 years, it was philanthropy. It was, you know, some nice people saying, hey, this community in Peru or Bolivia or Rwanda needs a bridge. Let's go and build it for them. And we went around the world building one bridge at a time. And then we did the, you know, back of the napkin mathematics on, well, how many bridges does the world actually need? Like, if this is a global problem, can we try solve it in our lifetimes?
Yeah.
And when we calculated the need for bridges and how much money it would take to build all those bridges ourselves, one, we could not do that in our lifetimes. We could never scale that big. And two, we would need to financially be the size of the World Bank.
Yeah.
So that's when the strategy was like, let's move from building bridges to getting bridges built.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where we work with the private sector, the public sector, the talent of a country through their vocational training and universities, to make sure that there is a machine that will build these bridges long after we live.
Being one of the leaders of a large INGO, I can really honestly congratulate you to that approach, because this is what CARE is globally discussing back and forth. How can we scale good initiatives and things that work well? And how can we hand them over? Partly it works, partly it doesn't, because philanthropy is not the way into the future, and it's definitely not the way to scale global good ideas, especially when it comes to infrastructure, but also to other topics. I have heard, Nivi, that you shared that in one of your interviews, and so my question that, and I'm not talking, I don't like to talk about Africa as a continent, but in this case, I think it is appropriate, that 60% of rivers and waterways are unmapped in Africa. Mm-hmm. Did I understand that correctly? And you asked rightly, then how can we build infrastructure without knowing the landscape? Is it still like that, honestly?
It's still like that. If you go to, you know, the maps that you would use most often, Apple Maps, Google Maps, that the consumer would use, most of rural Africa, let alone the waterways, where rivers, streams, and you know, when I say waterways or rivers, they're often seasonal. Doesn't mean that a community has water in front, flowing water in front of it 365 days. But even 2 months can, you know, cause a delay or education poverty for a girl whose school is on the other side. So waterways are definitely not mapped, and those are difficult to map because they move and they change. But even communities, like in an entire community of 100, 1,000 people cannot even be a dot on some of these maps. They don't, you know, their livelihoods, their aspirations and ambitions, what they represent, the work that they do, does not appear on these maps.
But this is changing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think in terms of data equity. We are trying to do a lot more work. Google has released some really interesting new tools for Google Earth and mapping and so on. We did a lot of work with the Better Planet Laboratory on this research specifically, on saying that, hey, we know, you know, where our rivers are, where we built bridges along. So using that as kind of training data for an AI model, along with satellite images and deep elevation models, we were able to actually map very accurately not only waterways in the countries where we are, but globally, and triple the amount of mapped waterways. But those maps, even, you know, rather than stay in a very academic setting, still need to be incorporated into mainstream mapping technology.
And I can imagine that the governments have a huge interest in tapping into that knowledge, right?
Yes. And, you know, with governments, we try and really take it out that, okay, a water is a barrier, so we need to map the barriers. But then we need to also map the solutions. We need to map where, if these are the barriers, then what and where are the ideal solutions to connect populations to their critical destinations. We need to, once we do that, we need to estimate the cost of those, and then we can overlay the impact and really see the barrier, the solution, the cost, and the impact, and the, at the end of the day, the return on investment of this kind of infrastructure.
And do you see a huge interest of the large tech companies to cooperate with you?
I mean, you know, large tech companies are driven by their own businesses. So, you know, a lot of mapping has been driven by mapping businesses, people selling things online specifically, wanting to put ads online for what they're selling. So I don't think that governments should rely on large tech companies for their mapping and transportation prioritization and planning needs. But there are, you know, there is technology that governments use that we now plug into to elevate their asset management systems within a country.
I would like to highlight now the relevance and the importance of African-based tech companies in order to work with their own governments and to tap into the knowledge and the technological tools that the big tech companies are providing, because we all, including Europe, are totally relying more or less, but more than less, on usage of these global tools. But we need our own tech companies to adopt them to the European or the African context and to work with our own governments on making the best use of it. Would you agree to that?
Yeah, I think African governments are making more and more smart decisions around, you know, obviously the cost of acquiring tech, the quality of that tech, and then I think finally is... what maybe plays into the quality of that tech is the proximity of that technology. Like, how contextually and culturally rooted in reality is this technology? You know, sometimes something that's built by someone sitting in San Francisco won't be as useful to us as we're, you know, working to make plans about rural Côte d'Ivoire.
Yeah, that's true. But with the adaptation and with scientists on the ground, it might be a useful core tool to bring it to the level that you can use it then in Cote d'Ivoire or in Kenya or wherever, right?
Exactly. And you know, I think one of the big waves of artificial intelligence that's coming, we have to remember that artificial intelligence has to be trained. So if you're teaching it, you know, whether how to write a journal or identify pictures of a dog, you have to show it lots and lots of journals. You have to show it lots of pictures of dogs, but also cats and tables and, you know, water bottles and so on. And in the same way, when we're creating artificial intelligence to help us make plans around Africa, we have to train it with African data.
Absolutely.
Because it's a unique data set.
So you might have noticed that I'm a big fan of African tech companies, because I know quite a lot of people who are doing exactly that, using the global tools and then train them for the context that it is used. And I have heard that also governments like Rwanda and I think also Uganda even invested years ago already to translate ChatGPT in local languages, that people can make the best use of it, because the language barrier for educated people, it's not that high, but for people who speak only Kiswahili, for example, which is one of the largest, which is the largest language in East Africa, at least. But then it gets more and more difficult to use AI tools. And I always say to make the best use of AI tools, you have to have quite a bit of education. Otherwise, it's not working well. Would you agree?
Yeah, and when you think about Africa's very profound linguistic, cultural, and contextual diversity, there are, 2,000 languages, 200 major languages and dialects, including Swahili, Hausa, Yoruba, and so on. And you find a village in rural Chad where, maybe someone's having a complication in childbirth, a community health worker shows up. What language she can speak to the people in the room to understand what's happening, or tell them what she's going to do or how she's going to deal with the situation. There is a huge opportunity to bridge those barriers, especially in language.
Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, we have to come to an end, but let's close with some thoughts on sustainable development. Where do you see the future of the so-called sustainable development? Is it... Because I always, from my perspective, I think we should not be too shy to tap into totally new models, to make use of the new technology tools, and not to romanticize this idea of basic, basic is enough. Basic is that what this an NGO is doing. I would say the contrary. In order to stay relevant, we have to open our eyes and ears and listen to what people want. And if we as a large NGO want to stay relevant, then we have to be totally open-minded, also to provide access to new technologies, because this might widen the gap even more than the whole poverty discussion between those who have access and those who have not. What is your take on that, Nivi?
Well, the quote-unquote death of aid that we see, I'll speak only about Africa specifically.
Yeah.
All African governments are kind of faced with a choice right now. And that choice is either to mourn the death of aid and go down with it, or really say that, okay, we have less and we need to do more with it. Mm-hmm. And we need to build more from other sources other than aid. And with that less that's coming through in terms of kind of philanthropic capital through aid, it really is down to governments. And I see a lot of governments in Africa rising to that occasion and saying, we are going to do more with less. We are going to make smarter investments. We are going to make better choices. We are going to invest in really transformational, catalytical interventions. And for government, my opinion is, take care of infrastructure. And I don't just mean a transportation infrastructure.
Yeah.
Take care of transportation, connect people. Take care of electricity, connect people to electricity, because you can't have a growing economy without power. Think about internet access. Again, you can't have a growing economy without power and connectivity. And in rural areas, think about water. Then water needs to reach farmers. That's one of the biggest, challenges that farmers have in terms of their yield and being able to develop sustainably. Everything else, education, healthcare, other than from a government access and provision point of view, almost everything else we need to think about direct cash transfers to improve people's livelihoods in accessing the services that they need. But, I think the governments are really scaling down and saying, how can we focus on the very basics of what a government needs to do, what we need to provide, so people can unlock their own opportunities through private sector, through their own subsistence farming, through their own access to labor markets and so on. But, allow the private sector to thrive, but the government really needs to go back to basics and think about where they're prioritizing. Is it shiny expressways and infrastructure for urban, or is it really the small and beautiful of rural?
So I think these are very nice closing words. I can assure you that CARE is having exactly the same discussions. We are also in close contact with many of the governments in the countries that we are working in. Scaling is one of our top topics, and also how we bring and how we leverage the benefits. There are also disadvantages, but we focus on the benefits of the new technology tools, and we are also looking for new partners to try new things, which is the future. So Nivi, it is extremely nice to have met you at least virtually this time. Thank you for being the guest in the CARE in Action podcast. I wish you all the best. And I hope that we find a chance not only to meet again, but maybe we can do something together. I would love to.
Thank you so much, Andrea. Really honored to be here. And if you're ever in East Africa, I hope our paths can cross and we can meet in person.
This would be lovely. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This was CARE in Action, the podcast by CARE Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For more information about CARE and our projects, visit care.at. There you'll also find out how you can support our work. This podcast is made possible with the generous support of CC Real. Thank you for your commitment, which enables this series of conversations. See you next time.